This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. The publishers of scientific literature are up in arms. A young university student is attempting to cut into their profits. Here's how it works. Scientists all over the US do important research, usually funded by the government, so our tax dollars. They then publish their findings, and in doing so, essentially give away their written work to private publishers, who in turn sell back the rights to the papers to the scientific community and the public. If that sounds like a patently unfair model, Alexandra Elbakyan, a 27-year-old graduate student from Kazakhstan, also thinks so. A few years ago, she began a website called SciHub and began posting thousands of academic papers for others to access for free. Joining me now is Heather Joseph. She is the executive director of SPARC, which stands for the Scholarly Publishing and Academic Resources Coalition, a group that also wants more open access to scientific literature. Welcome to the show, Heather.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, was my description of it relatively accurate that, you know, we have academics all over the country. They write these papers. They're often funded by the government. And they write for prestige. They write for furthering, you know, knowledge of humanity. They usually write and then sign over their rights to that work. And then these companies simply come and curate, or not even curate, they simply come and take these journals, and for the privilege, I guess, of presenting them back to the public, they charge huge fees, even though they didn't actually create the works.
That's true. I mean, it seems almost unbelievable that that model exists, especially in the age where we have the internet, right, where you think it would be easy for scientists to be able to share their work freely among themselves. And, you know, publishers do add value to the mix, you know, and especially in a paper-based environment, that model made a little bit more sense when a publisher had to go through all of the expense of printing and then mailing out paper copies of journals to people. That service was a really important service. And of course, it's a service with real costs attached. Now that we have the internet, though, I think a lot of people, myself included, really had high hopes that the model would shift and that it certainly would get less expensive for us to be able to share scientific articles. But unfortunately, that has not been the case.
Have they been raising their prices?
On average, journal prices have gone up. They used to go up prior to, you know, the early 2000s. Double-digit inflation, 10, 15, 20% price increases were not unusual. It's a little bit more moderate now, but certainly year in and year out, we see an increase in costs.
So say a scientist wants to, as they're writing their paper and doing their research, they want to obviously see what else is out there. You can't do science in a vacuum. You always have to look at, you're building on everyone else's work. So you're always looking as just a matter of course, it's standard. You're going to be needing to access research that other people have done and refer to it, build on it. So how do scientists get a hold of that? Do the, you know, universities that they work for have subscriptions to these journals, or do they have to pay paper by paper?
So that your description again is exactly right. Science only advances when you can see the work of other people that came before you, read it, use it, build on it. And in general, you know, university and college libraries, academic libraries, do their very best to make sure that they subscribe to everything that they can afford to subscribe to in terms of important scholarly journals. There is no library. SPARC is a membership organization, and our members are academic and research libraries, largely here in the US. And we have no library that can afford to subscribe to every journal that they'd like to be able to provide to the students and the faculty on their campus. So faculty members frequently, you know, find themselves in a position of doing a search, coming up with an article that they think they'd like to read, clicking on the link to that article in their Google search, and coming up against a paywall that says, pay me $10, $20, $30 for the privilege of reading this article, if the library doesn't have a subscription to it. And they've gotten pretty creative in terms of the workarounds that they'll use to get access to the articles, because, you know, paying $20 or $30 a pop to read individual articles is a pretty expensive way to think about doing scholarship or doing research.
And sometimes you may not actually end up needing the article that you've or the paper that you've accessed, but you won't know till you actually can read it. And then there's also, say, scientists around the world. I mean, I can imagine, you know, scientists working in the global south who are, you know, trying to build on the work of scientists all over the world. You know, we have this ideal that science transcends borders, and yet, say, a scientist in China or Latin America, when they have to access an article for $20 or $30 translated into their home currency might add up to more than their, you know, salary.
Absolutely. And it's a real problem. I mean, the inequity in access to knowledge, you know, in and of itself is a real issue. And we really do find that, you know, science is a global enterprise. If you look at the research that's conducted on anything, I mean, think of Zika. Research, for example, you know, which is in the news right now, the teams of researchers that are working on this are not based solely in one country, right? They're based in Latin America, they're based in Africa, and all researchers need equal access to the same pool of information if we're going to solve big problems like Zika effectively. And so the inequity is a real issue.
And I'm so glad you put it in that context, because this isn't just about scientists, you know, having an easier time. This is about advancing the global knowledge. This is also about the public being able to access information. And this is where also this Kazakh student, Alexandria Elbakyan, comes in. She is a graduate student here in the United States, and she was obviously so disgusted by the current state of affairs that she simply decided to break the law, which is she's technically doing. And technically what she's doing, I suppose, is called piracy. And she created this online website, Sci-Hub, SCI-HUB, and I just tested it out this morning, Heather. My interest is in cancer. I have a lot of cancer in my family, and as a member of the public, I have the right to see what's out there in the literature. I want to know if my family members who might be getting cancer treatment are getting the latest, what's the latest studies on certain protocols that doctors might be prescribing. And so I typed it in, and there I got a bunch of articles, but I wouldn't be able to actually legitimately access, you know, articles legally except for what service she has provided.
So, you know, your story, I wish your story was unique. You know, the idea that science is conducted just for the benefit of scientists who, you know, are doing this for themselves is a real fallacy. The United States, for example, invests in scientific research in huge amounts of public tax dollars every year, roughly $60 billion. And they do it to come up with research that will accelerate discoveries that are going to help the public, right? Fuel the public good. And biomedical research, I think the cancer example is a really great example. There's, you know, I think no one who is faced with a health condition or, you know, a question about health that doesn't immediately kind of go to the web and look for the latest and best information. You know, there are options for getting access to some of the articles that we need, and those are articles that are published in what are called open access journals, which is a model that Spark works very hard to promote, where the costs of publication are covered up front, and then anybody, anytime, anywhere can get access for free to those articles, right? You never run into those toll barriers. But by and large, there still are an enormous number of articles you can only access through subscriptions. And I think Alexandra's frustration level, you know, rose to the point where she decided to take action and come up with an alternative model. While we never, you know, condone illegal access to articles, it's understandable why she was driven to the lengths that she was driven.
Now, she says that more than 150,000 papers are downloaded a day from Sci-Hub. This is still only a small fraction of legally obtained papers. Yet, of course, these companies are mad. And by the way, I should also draw a parallel between what she is doing and what another young man named Aaron Swartz did a few years ago. This was a young student who had a similar story. He was prosecuted by the government. He was charged. He actually tragically killed himself, possibly from the horrible pressure of what he was facing legally. Are their stories parallel in a way?
I think they are, unfortunately. You know, while we don't know what Aaron Schwartz's intention was with downloading articles, and he certainly, at least in part, was trying to illustrate the absurdity of having knowledge be commoditized and it being, you know, having to tie yourself into a knot or into a pretzel or risk an illegal action to get access to scientific knowledge or scholarly knowledge. So, yeah, I think unfortunately there are definitely parallels to be drawn.
And the government and these companies haven't, I understand, yet gone after or been able to yet go after Alexandra Elbakyan, but we'll see what happens. Heather, let's talk about the companies. One of the companies, a couple of different companies, one of them, Elsevier, is, I believe, the biggest one. And for our TV audience, I want to play an excerpt of or a clip of this sort of video that they put out, this very glossy and beautiful video where they essentially declare, and here's a quote from the video, they declare, "We're dedicated into turning uncommon knowledge into common knowledge." And, you know, it's pretty amazing to see these companies use the same language that people like Aaron Swartz and Alexandra Elbakyan did, which is to liberate scientific knowledge, liberate academic information. These companies claim they are doing that. They say that, you know, the impression that they're giving to the public is that they're providing this really important service, making science and scientific literature accessible to everybody. What do you make of what they're doing and this kind of impression that they put out there, Heather?
You know, I think that it's a smart business strategy. And I do think there are some folks in those companies who are obviously well-intended and working to promote scientific knowledge. But
what are they doing to promote scientific knowledge? They're actually not doing anything to promote scientific knowledge. They're not creating the content. They're putting a paywall between scientists and the public and scientific knowledge.
Yeah, that is true. I do think collecting this information and organizing it is a value add. I'm not defending the business practices, and that's where I think the rub is, and where the real conflict comes in, is that to commoditize knowledge, right? To put a price tag on it, to say only people who can afford access are allowed to have access, is really at odds with the messaging that they're giving. And, you know, I think that it's a real challenge for the community to say, we're actually contributing our articles by publishing in these journals. We're actually kind of enabling these business models to go forward. So the scientific community and the academic community also has to really, you know, kind of do a little bit of self-assessment and say, we need to be much more proactive about the choices that we're making and where we're putting our articles. If we don't like these business practices, we should not support these companies by publishing our science in these journals. These companies don't make any secret of the fact that they're for-profit companies, right? That's why they exist, for profit maximization. They have shareholders. That's what they do. We need to be smart and be better, you know, educated consumers and say, we're not going to play. We're not going to give our articles to these journals.
So the money that goes into creating the information are our tax dollars, and the money that comes out of creating that information are corporate profits. Another company is Association of American Publishers. Again, you know, this like glossy language that makes it seem that, you know, on their website cover, they have an image of three little boys looking at a book under, you know, a cover of a blanket. Those three little boys would have had to shell out, what, $35 per paper to look at what they're looking at? And with the logo, "We are the voice of American publishing, supporting and publicizing its critical role worldwide." I mean, honestly, what can scientists do if they feel like, you know, if they're sort of hamstrung into this system, short of kind of going rogue? There needs to be action from the top, right? No, I mean, individual scientists can't take on this juggernaut that's already been established.
Yeah, and many of them have really worked to organize and to do very creative and very productive things. there's a couple things that you can do. I mean, first and foremost, look for an open access journal, you know, published by a nonprofit or published by a company that is not a a strictly profit-seeking organization. And there's lots of them out there.
But isn't where you publish also sort of part of the prestige? You know, say I used to be an astronomer, and if you publish in the Astrophysics Journal or the Astronomy Journal, then you've kind of made it an astronomer. But if you publish in a journal that people haven't heard of as much or just not considered as prestigious, your career suffers.
Absolutely. And, you know, that again is on, it's a culture, a common cultural practice in the academic community, and academics can change it, right? We in the university environment, whether you're an administrator or whether you're a researcher going up for tenure, we need to credit the behavior of making our papers as widely available as possible. We need to make open the default and reward scientists for sharing their papers openly and widely, and not for publishing in journals that shut people out of being able to benefit from science, participate in science, benefit from the results of science.
Now, Heather, I understand that a company like Elsevier is also going after scientists for publicizing their own papers. So say if I write a paper, I get it published in a journal that, you know, then is required to charge people for accessing it, but it's my paper, so I put it on my own website. And, you know, some scientists then realize they can simply go to my website and get that paper from there. Elsevier is, I understand, cracking down on that as well.
We hear stories about that sometimes. I mean, in general, use on your own website should be something that you absolutely have the right to do. Publishers have gotten a little bit better over the last decade in terms of recognizing that research, there are certain things that researchers are just going to do, and it's just common sense to support them in doing that. And certainly, posting your own work on your own website or using your own work as a teaching tool in your classroom is something that has to be supported. And the majority of publishers are, I would say, pretty good about actually supporting those uses. There are exceptions, however. And in 2016, for somebody to say to a researcher, you can't use your own website to promote your own work seems absurd.
I also understand that the fees that people have to pay are so high that they can actually sort of turn into the reason why certain academic institutions dissolve. I mean, I was reading last year a linguistics journal named Lingua. Six of its editors and 31 members of its editorial board quit. And it was over the high fees that this company, Elsevier, charges authors and academic institutions to see their journal. How does Elsevier promote knowledge when they're charging so many fees that they've essentially squashed the creator of knowledge in this one case? I mean, see it sort of hampering information, right?
Yeah, that's the fine question. I mean, that's a question definitely to ask Elsevier directly. I mean, I have no defense for that.
Yeah. All right, so how can finally people find your organization, get involved with this idea of open access, not just if you're a scientist, but if you're a member of the public who feels like this is common information. This should be the public commons. My tax dollars, your tax dollars have gone into creating this information, paying scientists to do the research. We should have this access to public information, especially at an age when, unfortunately, people can Google so much stuff, and there's so much of the free stuff that's out there hasn't been peer-reviewed. Whereas if the peer-reviewed stuff was available, maybe it might actually give people equal access to the stuff that is solid, that we know has some sound basis. What can people do, the public and scientists?
So one of the main things you can do is our organization is very active in working to promote legislation that would make all publicly funded science readily and easily publicly accessible online. So there's actually legislation in front of Congress right now. And if you come to the SPARC website, which is www.sparkopen.com, you can find information about a bill called FASTER that's in front of the U.S. Senate right now, the Fair Access to Science and Technology Research Act, which would require that if a researcher writes an article that's based on research that's been funded by the U.S. government, the U.S. Public has a right to free and fast access to articles, all articles reporting on that research. So you can get involved politically and support this legislation. It's amazingly, it has bipartisan support in the House and the Senate, and it's active now.
That is rare, certainly, to have bipartisan support, particularly when it comes to science. You know, there's a certain one of our two major parties that sometimes seems quite, let's just say, resistant to science and what science has offered. Thank you so much, Heather. Give out that website again.
www.sparkopen.org.
And we'll post a link to that from our website. Thanks so much, Heather.
Thank you.
Heather Joseph is the executive director of SPARC, which stands for Scholarly Publishing and Academic Resources Coalition. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. If you enjoyed this interview, you can watch it online at our website, risingupwithsonali.com.